I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. Have you seen Christopher Nolan's blockbuster film, The Odyssey? It's playing to sold-out theaters around the world and has gotten mostly positive reviews from critics. It tells the nearly 3,000-year-old story of Odysseus and his 10-year journey after the Trojan War, battling monsters and temptations to get home to Ithaca, his wife Penelope, and reclaim his kingdom. The poem is among the oldest stories in Western literature with extraordinary staying power, having been translated numerous times. Our guest Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey in 2017 was praised for making Homer's language fresh and accessible to modern readers. Her critical review of Nolan's movie has generated a lively and sometimes heated debate about the poem, the movie, and her reaction. She's department chair and professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She has translated both the Iliad and the Odyssey. Her most recent book is titled Crossing the Wine Dark Sea, and she's got another Odyssey book in the works. And Emily Wilson, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Neil Burton. He's a psychiatrist and philosopher at the University of Oxford, author of The Meaning of Myth, among many other books. And Neil Burton, nice to have you with us today on The Connection as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let me start with your review, Emily, of the film. And I'll just quote a couple of lines that you wrote in a pretty extended review. You wrote, Nolan's Odyssey lacks many of the elements that make the poem great. It has nothing convincing to say about time, memory, history, war, or about the relationship between one warrior's glorious return and the lives of his family, adversaries, comrades, friends, and neighbors. It lacks psychological, emotional, political, and ethical depth. Its narrative structure is gimmicky. The writing is abysmal. None of the characters has convincing motivation for their actions or words. There are no sex scenes, and all the food looks horrible. I wanted to quote that, and I'm just absolutely fascinated why this movie, I won't say triggered you, but got such an emotional reaction from you.
You know, I wanted it to have more of an emotional reaction. I wanted to feel moved. I wanted to care about these characters. I mean, I think it's primarily my problem with the film was not it's different from the poem, but just that I think it's aiming for doing too many different things and therefore not able to do any of them as well as I would like, given what an amazing cast it has, what a huge budget it has, these wonderful settings, locations. And yet I just felt this amazing cast is in a way being wasted on something which feels so overstuffed.
Do you feel like Nolan betrayed Homer and the poem?
I honestly don't care about portraying Homer. I mean, I don't think the job of a filmmaker is to do an analysis of an ancient poem. I think he betrayed his own purposes as a filmmaker if his goal was to really dig into, for instance, the relationship of Odysseus, Penelope, Telemachus, and explore what does this homecoming journey mean on its own terms.
So he bit off too much of the poem to tell the kind of story you were looking for?
I think adaptations of the Odyssey, or of anything, are better if they really understand what can I do in this medium with this scale of narrative. I mean, obviously, James Joyce's Ulysses is an enormous novel. It does something completely different from what Homer does, but it does it in an amazing way. It advances what the novel can do as well as reacting to Homer. Tennyson's poem Ulysses is a tiny poem compared to the scale of a 3-hour poem, let alone 24-book epic, and yet it does something really coherent on its own terms. I think Nolan needed to make more choices.
But do you feel, and people are as flocking to this movie, I think we all know that, I think it's close to $1 billion in sales, which is pretty extraordinary. Are you concerned that people are going to come away from this movie with the wrong idea about this story and what it's all about?
I actually don't really mind about that. I hope that the viewing of the film, which is a very spectacular, intense experience, and I'm absolutely not surprised that people are flocking. I'm going to see it again myself,
and
I'm mostly looking forward
to
it. And I'm hoping that I'll, you know, maybe it'll warm on me. I think it's great that people are engaging with art and discussing it. And I think it's wonderful if there's a work of art that inspires a public conversation and a public debate, and that there's more than one perspective that can be shared respectfully, I hope, and that it also invites people to turn back to ancient literature and think about how is this film both doing its own thing and also responding to something else.
And we will talk about the Odyssey itself, but Neil, let me get you in on the conversation, because Emily has kicked up a lot of dust with her review and commentary. You saw the film. What did you make of it?
Well, I didn't pull my hair out, put it that
way.
In fact, I enjoyed it, and I was moved in places. And, you know, of course, the film isn't judged by the same standards as a translation, but they do have something in common, which is that both are trying to bring Homer alive for a contemporary audience, to persuade a modern audience that, you know, 3,000-year-old story is worth their time. And one thing I did notice while watching the film, it was packed and nobody left for 3 hours. Three-hour film, nobody left. And even nobody really spoke, which is quite remarkable.
It is.
And so the audience stayed with it. And, of course, that doesn't mean the film is a masterpiece. And I can completely see Emily's point of view. And, of course, you know, being the person I am, I would have liked to see more being done. But at the same time, I wonder whether the risk is, if more was done, whether fewer people would come. Mm-hmm. So it's that trade-off, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah,
I think you're totally right about that. I mean, in my piece, I do a brief aside comparing the Nolan film adaptation of The Odyssey to this very low-budget film, The Return, which starred Ralph Fiennes, Juliette Binoche, came out in, I think, 2024. And it didn't have nearly the same cultural impact. It's a very, very spare adaptation of the poem, of the story, which takes a lot of things out. I felt it was more coherent because it takes things out and does only what it can manage in the time using the resources that it has. But also, maybe coherence isn't the only thing. Mm. This is a thing which includes a lot. It doesn't all fit together. Maybe that's okay.
Well, I find, and I do want to move beyond the debate that's been going on. And I have to say, yes, there's a stupid debate about the translation, the movie, your translation. But I also am seeing, and this is largely online, people having passionate, well thought out, I would say, debates and arguments about the film, your reaction to it, and to Homer and the Odyssey itself. Mm-hmm. That's got to be a good thing.
I think that's got to be a good thing. I mean, I hope that it's... the film is also clearly not just about the Odyssey, but also about our present moment. What's happening with xenophobia? How do we respond to media manipulation and lies as themes of our times and supposedly of this made-up version of the Mycenaean era? But it's really about our times. And I hope that it's also prompting some conversation about that, about whose stories do we center and what is it that might be causing and what can we do about a culture of unkindness and of hatred.
You want to pick up on that, Neil? And I had the same as I was watching it as well. And I have to say, I enjoyed it for what it was. I didn't come in with giant expectations. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to see a good Christopher Nolan film, and I enjoyed it. But I felt like, gosh, it is such a reflection on the world, even beyond America today, with migration, with war, with suffering, with loneliness. And it seems like he just tapped into something that's really very raw around the world.
Well, that's the thing with a work like The Odyssey, such a great work of art, is that, you know, you can project your own time and your own needs into it. So every new generation sees something new in that film and reflects themselves. And so we think we're interpreting the Odyssey. Actually, in some way, it's interpreting us. It's helping us to work through our own issues, our own problems. Yeah.
What do you see those problems and issues as being, Neil?
Well, I think that, again, that depends on who you are. You can see what you want. I think a soldier will see something very different in that film from, say, a parent or from Emily or from me. We all see what interests us. Or, you know, Freud, for example, would have seen a sort of landscape of the unconscious in The Odyssey, you know, because that's what he was interested in. So what the problems are, what the problems you see are the problems that you yourself are worried about.
Well, I wanted to, Emily, and I agree. I think we all project onto the stories that we hear, whether it's the Odyssey or anything mm-hmm. else. But even as a translator, I'm assuming you bring some of your own projections to the work that you're working on.
I think I certainly bring, I mean, everyone has different perspectives. I mean, everyone has different both life experience and also different scholarly training and literary training. I mean, I personally think that one of the primary features of my training that's relevant for my translations is that I have degrees in English literature as well as classics, that I really care about metrical poetry and what can the English language do in terms of traditional poetic form. And I'm bringing that perspective as well as my experience as a classical scholar to my work as a translator. But of course, I'm also bringing a response to what does Homer mean in this particular moment.
Well, and you were 8 years old. You were in your first play, I guess, of the Odyssey, and mm-hmm. you played
before Zendaya did it. I did it. Yes, I was Athena. Yes.
You were Athena. So this is some. I mean, does this feel personal? Does it feel part of your identity? Your even your family growing up. This story.
I've lived with this story for many, many years. That doesn't mean I own it. It means that I'm constantly rethinking it, rereading it, seeing it in different ways. I mean, you've referred up top to the fact that I'm re-translating the Odyssey. I'm assessing it all over again. I'm constantly rethinking, what does it mean now? How else can we respond to this passage, this line, this poem?
What keeps bringing you back?
So many things. I mean, I just think it's such a rich poem. And we've already hinted at some of these themes of technology, of the relationship between strangers and those who are familiar to us. What is a community? What is it to be recognized? What is it to have a person or an identity over time? I think this poem has so much to say to us about how time can either move forward or move backwards, and whether we have any control over time and what the costs are of trying to control time through technology, through violence, through all these different ways that Odysseus is sort of trying to echo the skills of the sun god in controlling time.
And we're almost having a break here. Controlling time because he wants to get home, because he's been away so long.
So he's going back to his past self as well as to his past home, yes.
Do you agree with that, Neil? We're almost having a break here, but that he's going back to his past self.
Yeah, I just want to say, well, you know, there's another reason, a quite simple reason, why the Odyssey is still so popular and why it has remained popular for 3,000 years, more or less. And it's quite simple. It's because it's a wonderful story. It's a great story.
Totally true.
It's an adventure story. It's got shipwrecks. It's got monsters. It's got disguises. It's got escape. It's got revenge. And, you know, even children enjoy it, right? Mm-hmm. And they made cartoons out of it. I remember watching it as a cartoon. So there's many levels on it. Mm-hmm. You know, on one level, it's about recognition, memory, identity, mm-hmm. and all these complex yes. themes. It's also just a great story.
It's a fun story. Totally agree. Yes.
Well, the story we're talking about is The Odyssey, talking with Neil Burton and with Emily Wilson. And it is, of course, in the movie theaters. And Emily did a translation of The Odyssey. We're going to get a reading in a little bit as well. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking with Emily Wilson. She is Department Chair, Professor of Classical Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She has translated both the Iliad and the Odyssey. And we are talking about the Odyssey, the film, and we're going to have some readings as well. Neil Burton is with us, and he's a psychiatrist and philosopher at the University of Oxford. He's written a number of books, including one called The Meaning of Myth. We've been talking about the movie, The Odyssey, and we do want to move into a discussion of the Odyssey itself. But I just want to toss one thing out. Last night, my husband and I watched Oh Brother, Where Art mm-hmm. Thou? Just because there's so much discussion about all these various translations mm-hmm. and adaptations of the film The Odyssey. I think they take The Odyssey and throw in a lot of The Wizard of Oz, but nonetheless. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, The Odyssey is the Wizard of Oz, vice versa. Right?
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because yes. Dorothy is sort of our...
Dorothy is going home. She's got a Nostos journey, a journey home, yes.
But is that why some of these stories like The Odyssey just keep getting retold, because of the richness of of what they are telling us.
I mean, I think it's very difficult to tell a story of coming, of a homecoming journey that isn't in some way or other reinventing the Odyssey. I mean, how else are you going to do that?
Right.
How could you just
get
ignore
home,
that?
Right.
Gotta get home. Yes. So there are so many narratives within world literature that are engaged in some way or other with the story of the Odyssey. Yes.
I was also thinking, Neil.
There was a chap in the 19th century, I think, Lord Raglan, and he studied the mythological narratives and legendary narratives, and he identified 22 recurring features of mm-hmm. mythical and legendary heroes. Emily, no doubt you've heard of Raglan.
Mm, yes.
And, you know, he finds that, you know, mythical heroes like Moses and Oedipus will meet almost all the 22 criteria, you know, things like a miraculous birth, an attempt on the infant's life, a royal destiny. But when it comes to Odysseus, he measured only eight. Only eight of these features of a legendary hero were met.
Hmm.
And so this is what's so interesting with Odysseus, is that he's the greatest of the Western heroes in many ways, but he's also an incomplete hero, a massively incomplete hero. And that's precisely the point. Mm-hmm. And he's just a simple man, you know, sing, O muse of the men, Andra.
Mm-hmm.
He's resourceful, but he's a human. And he's complicated mm-hmm. and he's incomplete. Part mm-hmm. of being complicated is being incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we can actually project on him and relate with him. I think that's so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your translation, Emily, mm-hmm. you know, tell me about a complicated man. Mm-hmm. Is he a hero from your perspective? Do you see him as a hero? He is mm-hmm. a complicated man.
He's
guises, many personas, mm-hmm. many identities.
Exactly, and many turns and twists in this complicated journey, this complicated narrative. He's certainly a heros. So within the Greek archaic tradition and classical tradition, a heros is a character who does extraordinary things, who's is in some ways larger than life, who's close to the gods, who does things that would be impossible for most ordinary mortals. In that sense, yes, he's absolutely a heros. Is he a nice guy who's always saving other people? in that sort of somewhat sentimental idea of the hero has to be an old school Superman kind of character.
Right.
Obviously, that's anachronistic within the world of archaic Greek thought. He's a different kind of hero from that.
In fact, Neil, you talk about in myth, it's about the ambiguousness of people or of characters. And we're all made up of, you know, so-called good and bad qualities.
I think Emily is onto something when she says that the concept of a hero has changed a lot since ancient times. And the Christian hero who's sort of self-sacrificing and cares about, you know, full of compassion, that's not what a Greek hero is at all.
Right.
These are not, you know, ancient Greek qualities. And so, and this is a problem that, say, Nolan would have when making the film, right? It's like, how do you portray a hero and make their hero relatable to modern audiences? And some people have complained that in the film there's a bit, there are perhaps seeping Christian themes, for mm-hmm. instance.
Yeah.
And that's always a difficult one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. How should we see him, though, Odysseus? How should we see him? I mean, again, getting out of the mm-hmm. binary of either good or evil, mm-hmm. but as a man struggling with himself as he tries to journey his way home?
I think he's struggling to achieve what all Homeric characters want to achieve, which is eternal kleos, eternal glory. And he's doing it in very unusual, strange circumstances. So in contrast to Hector or Achilles in the Iliad, who are seeking eternal fame on the battlefield through risking their lives facing other warriors, Odysseus is seeking eternal fame through these paradoxical means of this long period of being nobody, being in hiding, and yet that's what will make him ultimately somebody forever.
From nobody to somebody.
From nobody to somebody.
Yeah, go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, so on the surface, the Odyssey is a story about a man trying to get home, and I think
right.
everybody gets that. But psychologically, it's actually about becoming yourself. Mm-hmm. Odysseus is trying to find himself at a deep level. So although his quest appears to be geographical, it's also psychological and moral. And the geography is actually almost incidental, because every island essentially asks him the same question in a different form. For example, the lotus eaters ask him, will you forget who you are?
Mm-hmm.
Circe asks him, will you become something less than human? Calypso asks him, will you give up your mortal life? Mm-hmm. And the cattle of Helios, for example, asks him, can you resist immediate gratification? So the external journey becomes an inner one. Which is, of course, a much more universal journey because, not everyone travels the Mediterranean in their ship, but we are all on this same inner journey of trying to find ourselves. We're all trying to find our way home in that sense. And our way home is not simply a place, but a life that feels genuinely our own.
That's so
Years
interesting.
ago,
Yes,
yeah,
let me just jump in because I know you want to say something and I want to hear what you have to say. But something that you said, Neil, really jogged a memory that I had being in London and going to Freud's office, which was there very briefly, and then he died shortly after arriving. But I went to his office
Hampstead,
filled, in Hampstead, filled with these artifacts from Greece and Rome. And clearly he was inspired by these stories. But I wonder
Absolutely.
Whether, the monsters, the gods became, through Freudian analysis, our internal struggles. I mean, our own battles within ourselves to be the person that we want to be.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. And Freud was actually asked to be buried in an urn, with Dionysus, an ancient urn with Dionysus on it, which I think is very interesting.
It is. It
very
is.
Interesting.
What were you going to say, Emily?
I mean, there's a very long tradition of what I would call misreading, but really interesting misreading of the Odyssey in terms of it should be allegorized as an internal journey rather than an external journey. I mean, going all the way back to the Neoplatonic philosophers in their readings of Odysseus's journey as a quasi-philosophical, quasi-spiritual quest, Christian readings of the Odyssey in terms of Athena is guiding Odysseus to a sort of pilgrim's progress. Nolan is very much in tune with those readings of Odysseus's journey in psychological and internal ways. It seems to me that the original poem is actually about seeking social recognition. It's not actually, as far as I can see, the case that in the poem Odysseus doesn't know himself. He knows himself. He wants everyone else to know him too. And that's the challenge of achieving eternal fame. It's much more external, much more social, much more about these multiple different complicated relationships. And I think it's also the part of the richness and sort of infinite rereadability and reinterpretability of the poem that it can be reinterpreted through these internal ways, but I actually don't think that's what the archaic poem is doing.
I mean, what I saw was a man struggling, to be use very crass terms, with PTSD, with having engaged in violence, having seen violence, feeling some sense of responsibility for what he created. We'll have you read about the Trojan horse, and struggling with his own internal anxiety and guilt and depression about what he has done with his life. Does that fit with you at all, Emily?
I think there's this possibility of reading, I mean, the passage I'll read from the Trojan Horse passage from the Odyssey really invites us to think about how does Odysseus feel about what he's done in the Trojan War? Does he feel pity for his victims? Does he feel regret? Does he feel guilt? Does he feel sad he's not doing that anymore, that he's separated from that identity of being the warrior and he's so far from who he used to be? He gets back to that warrior identity at the very end of the poem where he gets to start slaughtering again.
Yeah.
And it seems in some ways as if he's back full circle to a kind of homecoming when he's back on the battlefield.
Neil, do you want to weigh in on this at all? And then
the PTSD question. Well, just to come back to something Emily said, I think it's, that the ancient hero pursues fame and renown, or what the Greeks call kleos. There's also this interesting, Homer seems to be a bit nuanced about that in the Odyssey, and that's definitely a very strong theme in the Iliad, but maybe not so much in the Odyssey, because you've got this odd moment where Odysseus actually pretends to be no one and says his name is nobody.
Right.
And it's almost like a Sartrean existential moment, this, that his greatest moment of glory, if you like, comes when he says, actually, I'm nobody. And when he does reveal his name, because he can't resist it at the end to get the honor, and he almost loses himself by revealing his name. I think that's an interesting sort of ambiguity there about fame and identity and who you really are, your external persona and your internal persona.
Let me
and
just.
Anyway, Odysseus is never more himself and never more free than when he says, I am nobody.
Oh, yes. So, in a way, that's like being inside the Trojan horse, right? He's always repeatedly disguising himself as something less than what he is.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. And that's Emily Wilson. And we are talking about The Odyssey, which she translated in 2017 to much acclaim. And was in part, I think, an inspiration for Christopher Nolan's movie, which, of course, is
out now. And Neil Burton is a psychiatrist and philosopher at the University of Oxford. Well, Emily, I'd love to have you read a section. This is about the Trojan horse.
Yes.
So from the your translation horse, of the Odyssey, yes.
Yes. So the Trojan horse, I think people who haven't read the Odyssey or the Iliad recently are sometimes surprised that, oh, the Trojan horse comes in the Odyssey. It doesn't actually come in the Iliad. And it comes in a weird place in the Odyssey, where Odysseus is staying on this strange island called Scheria with the welcoming, hospitable Phaeacians who love sports and rowing and ships, and they also love storytelling. So there's a poet on Phaeacia, and Odysseus asks the poet to sing a special story, which is the story of the Trojan horse. So we get this description, which is inset with what the poet sings to Odysseus about his own greatest triumph at Troy. I'll read a tiny bit of the Greek, and then I'll just read the passage in my translation.
Sure.
Aise garen apolesthai, epen polisamphi kolupse, durate on megan hippon, hoth eata pantas eristoi, arge on tro essi phonon, kai kera pharontes. A god inspired the bard to sing. He started with how the Greeks set fire to their camp, and then embarked and sailed away. Meanwhile, Odysseus brought in a gang of men into the heart of Troy inside the horse. The town was doomed to ruin when it took that horse chock full of fighters bringing death to Trojans. And he sang how the Achaeans poured from the horse in ambush from the hollow and sacked the city, how they scattered out, destroying every neighborhood. Like Ares, Odysseus with Menelaus rushed to find Deiphobus's house. And there he won at last through dreadful violence, thanks to Athena. So the poet sang. Odysseus was melting into tears. His cheeks were wet with weeping, as a woman weeps as she falls to wrap her arms around her husband, fallen fighting for his home and children. She is watching as he gasps and dies. She shrieks, a clear high wail collapsing upon his corpse. The men are right behind. They hit her shoulders with their spears and lead her to slavery, hard labor, and a life of pain. Her face is marked with her despair. In that same desperate way, Odysseus was crying.
Thank you for reading that. That was absolutely stunning. We were just hanging on your every word. So what is he saying here? What is going on?
I mean, I think it's such a fascinatingly difficult passage to interpret, right? Because it's so surprising. Odysseus has chosen this story, and you think he's chosen this story to cheer himself up. This will surely be a happy thing for him to remember, because this is the moment where he broke through the impenetrable walls of Troy built by the gods. No one could do it. He came up with the ultimate war machine, this engine of deceit. He got through when no one else could. He hears this story, hears how he won the war, and yet he starts crying. Right. And then we get this amazing simile where you would think an elite warrior hearing about his own warrior triumph, how is that at all like the victim of all of these warriors, a woman whose husband is slaughtered in front of her, who's now going to be enslaved for the rest of her life? These things have nothing in common with each other. So I think going back to our conversation about what is Odysseus's emotional relationship to his own past self at Troy. Does he feel guilty? Does he feel distanced? What exactly is going on? I mean, I think it's one can understand this passage from several different perspectives, right?
But we have a sense of pain.
Go ahead.
A lot of people have said that, you know, Odysseus might have PTSD, especially in a Nolan film, right? And I think as a psychiatrist, I should say a few things about that.
You should indeed.
Because PTSD is actually a modern psychiatric construct, and it was first described after the First World War, when it was more likely to be known as shell shock or combat neurosis or even survivor syndrome. And common symptoms include anxiety, numbing, detachment, flashbacks, nightmares, and avoidance of reminders of the trauma. And the important thing is that these symptoms are not just there, but they predispose to other mental disorders or secondary mental disorders like depression and substance misuse. And obviously, it's not possible to diagnose a fictional character written 3,000 years ago. But he does have some features. Odysseus does have some features in keeping with PTSD. For example, he frequently weeps, which is pretty unusual for a Greek hero. And towards the end, he becomes hyper-vigilant when he gets back to Ithaca, although some might say rightly so. He's seen what happened to Menelaus. On the other hand, he functions really well. He's a very high functioning, so he's not impaired by his trauma, so to speak. And so what we're seeing, I think, is resilience more than pathology. And so the richer question, I think, is not whether he was suffering with PTSD, but what Homer understood about the psychological consequences of war, which I think is quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Homer knows that war doesn't end when the fighting stops. The veterans carry it home. And you can see it in the behavior of Odysseus's men. They're basically desperate for oblivion, desperate for pleasure, desperate for food, and of course also desperate for return. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Odyssey follows the Iliad. The Odyssey isn't about winning the war. It's about what happens to the people mm-hmm. who've lived through war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which seems very modern in a certain kind of way to sort of talk about the consequences of that.
It's such a modern story. The Odyssey is remarkable. Yeah. Even the narration is remarkably modern, because people think that it's narrated in a straight line from beginning to end. But actually, that's not what happens. It's all a flash. Most of it is a flashback. It's Odysseus telling his own story, the man of many resources telling his own story. And in fact, his voice then blends with Homer. He becomes Homer. So Homer is also a man of many resources, and so is Odysseus. And there's an identification going on there, which mm-hmm. is really interesting.
I mean, I guess I think one of the big reasons to study ancient literature is to correct presuppositions that we may have about what is modernity. I mean, such as the idea that modernity means sophistication. Modernity means an understanding of the complexities of the world, even including beyond the battlefield. That ancient literature is sophisticated, that doesn't mean it's modern. Actually, modernity doesn't have a complete monopoly on either sophistication or emotional mm-hmm. profundity or depth mm-hmm. of thought or feeling.
We're almost up at a rate here, but by that you mean there is psychological depth. It isn't just a sort
huge
of surface,
psychological
surface
and emotional depth. Absolutely.
Monsters
yes.
and shipwrecks and all that.
Yes,
kind of
it's
stuff.
Not. I mean, it is enjoyable to people of any age, interesting to people of any age. But this is not a kid's story. This is a story that's for all human beings and that's really profound in its understanding of human society.
Well, we are talking. Hold on 1 second, Neil. Only because we're up on a break. Sorry to do that to you. We are talking about The Odyssey today on The Connection. The movie, of course, is out. Our guest, Emily Wilson, wrote a translation of The Odyssey, a much regarded translation, a number of years ago. We've been talking about that as well. She just did a reading. And Neil Burton is a psychiatrist and philosopher. Much more after this short break. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about The Odyssey on the screen, on the page. And again, our guests are Neil Burton. He's a psychiatrist and philosopher at the University of Oxford. He's written a number of books, including The Meaning of Myth. Also with us is Emily Wilson, and she's department chair, professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She has translated both the Iliad and the Odyssey, and she's got another Odyssey book in the works, something I think you probably spend the rest of your life mining this particular story. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that there's so little sex. You have remarked on this. Others have as well, Emily, in this book, that Nolan seems to have made a sort of G-rated movie version.
It's R-rated, I think, but I think it's for the violence, not for the sex.
Exactly. But what are we missing out if we're, I guess, how sexy is The Odyssey? And what are we missing if we don't see it in the movie?
I mean, I think one of my favorite moments of The Odyssey is, I mean, many people's favorite moment of The Odyssey is when Odysseus and Penelope finally get back together and she tricks him by pretending that she's moved the immovable bed that he's constructed out of the tree growing in their house. And so, of course, she's testing him and reminding him that, in a sense, this is not an immovable bed. She could have had sex with someone else. The marriage is not immovable. Nothing is immovable. And so she's pushing his buttons by reminding him of those things. And then that's a test, because, of course, it's only she and he and one slave who know about this trick of the bed. And then after they're reunited, they have sex, and Athena extends the night so they can keep on having sex for longer, and then also telling
each
other their stories.
Years,
so, it's been a long time, but they still got it, which I think is great.
It is great.
I think that's really lovely. And I think so one of the things that I felt was, in a way, missing in the Nolan film was that The Odyssey is so much about the complexities, but also intensities of multiple kinds of desire. But it's not just sexual desire, which is not just the desire of Odysseus, but also of Calypso, of Circe, of all of these other characters who have desires. And then also the desire for honor, the desire for food. All of those are intertwined, the desire for community.
Well, and Neil, thinking of Calypso, where he, you know, he stays, at least in the poem there, for 7 years. And apparently there's a lot of sex that goes on there. I'm maybe reading too much into the poem. But in the film, it feels like she is his therapist.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I mean, in a very good therapist. I was a very, you know, warm and generous therapist, but nonetheless.
Oh, Neil, I want to know, do you think she's a good therapist in this film?
Oh,
I
really want to know about that.
Go ahead, go ahead. Does she follow up?
Well, I'd sign up.
Rogerian, yeah, right.
Anyway, so, but I think it's such an interesting episode, the Calypso, because she embodies one of humanity's oldest fantasies. She offers Odysseus everything we want: eternal youth, eternal life, freedom from suffering. Yet he turns it down.
Yeah.
And that's so interesting, because Homer seems to be suggesting that what makes life meaningful isn't that it lasts forever, but that it has a shape that belongs to us. And that's a point made by modern philosopher Bernard Williams, 20th century, who argued that immortality would drain life of its meaning because our loves and ambitions depend upon life's shape and finiteness. And the question is, you know, would love, loyalty, achievement, and home, things like that, have any real meaning in an eternally youthful life? And the answer, Homer's answer, seems to be no, they wouldn't.
Mm. And your answer is, as a psychiatrist yourself?
Well, actually, this is a question I really struggle with. I mean, you'd have to be God to know the answer to that question.
Fair enough. Well, let's talk about Argos, the dog. Mm-hmm. And when Odysseus comes back to Ithaca, he's dressed as a beggar. He has many disguises, and this is his disguise when he comes home. And it seems the only person or the only being that recognizes him is the dog. We shouldn't be surprised, because dogs are very smart.
Dogs know what someone smells like, what someone sounds like, so they're not going to be fooled by visual appearances, unlike human beings who are going to be listening to language and listening and looking to see, does that look like that person? The dog is not going to be fooled by any of that, because the dog doesn't care about that. And of course, it's this, I mean, heartbreaking, you know, goosebumps, tear-jerking episode in which the dog, who's been waiting and waiting and waiting for 20 years for the man who went hunting with him, who was his companion, to come back to him. But they, of course, they're never going to go hunting again, because the dog realizes it's Odysseus and then dies. And then it's sort of intertwined with what the poem has to say about loyalty, right? I mean, the ways that the dog can stay committed to this human being who was his master 20 years ago in a way that is actually more challenging, and maybe also less clearly motivated for human members of the household, who have much more competing loyalties than a dog necessarily does. In the original poem, it's sort of intertwined with a discussion by Eumaeus about what happens if an enslaved person is left by the master. Do they still want to keep on doing the work of the enslaver if the enslaver is gone? Maybe a dog does, but does a person want that? So I think it's really interesting how there's this sort of juxtaposition of what is a dog, what is a slave. Those are beings in the household who are both subordinate to Odysseus and supposed to help him with his work and the generation of his honor, but they may be somewhat different in what they feel and think and want.
Neil, let me go back to you. And you have written about Argos, the dog, but also about the importance of recognition, of being recognized for us human beings, to be known. And it seems like the dog in certain ways represents, if we're going to be totally symbolic about it, but sort of represents this need, this desire.
Absolutely. So recognition is one of our deepest needs, as you say. And long before we seek fame and deeds, we seek to be known. So friends delight us in being understood without explanation. Lovers hope to be recognized beneath the depredations of time, like happens with Odysseus and Penelope indeed. And so one of the quietest forms of suffering in life is not to be hated, but to be neglected, to become as if you're invisible. So
That's
to
why
recognize,
shunning is so powerful. Shunning.
so powerful, yeah. To recognize literally means etymologically, to know again, to re-know. To recognize someone is to perceive beneath altered appearances and enduring existence of a person. It's the gift of seeing through the disguise. So Argos's recognition is instinctual, not rational like a human's might be. So here Homer seems to suggest that there's a form of knowledge more fundamental and more faithful than reason itself, that love sees what intelligence cannot. And coming to this Argos dog, what's really interesting, because I've written on Indian mythology and philosophy as well, is that in the Mahabharata, the great Indian epic, by the way, there's two great epics in India, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and they pretty much map onto the Iliad and the Odyssey, which is really interesting, but that's for another time.
It is.
But in the Mahabharata, there is a dog as well. And he has the same virtues as Argos in the Odyssey, which is faithfulness. And he's got a very prominent role in the Mahabharata, because at the end of the when all the fighting is done, the Pandava brothers, the heroes, the warriors, they journey to heaven, to Mount Meru, and are followed by this stray dog. And one by one, they fall on the ascent, leaving only the eldest of the Pandavas, King Yudhishthira, to arrive at the gates of heaven. And Indra, the god Indra, invites him into heaven, but refuses to admit the dog, the stray dog. And he returns away. He says, "I'm refusing heaven because I cannot abandon my faithful companion." And
So
so at
beautiful.
that,
That is
it's so
beautiful.
beautiful. And at that point, the dog reveals himself as none other than Dharma, which means cosmic order, duty, or right way of living. And of course, both of them are then admitted into heaven because they were faithful to one another.
That's a
And so,
beautiful,
love that.
powerful
Just,
story.
yes. And so both Homer and the authors of the Mahabharata arrived at the same intuition that the fidelity of a dog is not merely an animal instinct, it's a revelation. It's something we can learn from.
I'm going to underscore that. That's absolutely beautiful. You know, we haven't talked about, is it Xenia, Xenia?
Zinnia, yes.
Xenia,
Yes.
which is the sort of welcoming, the hospitality, the
Yes.
welcoming of strangers, the law of Zeus, as it
Yes.
is said in the film. What do we need to know about that?
We need to know that the Odyssey, I mean, it's so many different things. We've sketched many of the things the poem is doing, but among all of that, it's an exploration of this concept of Xenia, of the proper relationships between people who are not related to each other by bonds of blood, and the possibility that you can meet someone who isn't part of your family and yet not kill him. Isn't that weird? And so Xenia is about this possibility that instead we can have these social institutions which go with what you should do as a guest and what you should do as a host. Ideally, these then form lasting multi-generational relationships between elite men. So it's part of how the archaic Greek world was starting to form these ideas of we could form larger communities than just the household. We can move towards urbanization and a larger kind of community. The Odyssey is constantly exploring how can that go wrong? What if Odysseus is stuck with Calypso? Part of being a good host is you help the guest get on his way. You don't make the guest stay forever, which is what Calypso is doing. Not she's only a partially great host. Or you give food that's too good so the guest gets too drunk or too stoned, which is what the Lotus Eaters. Or you, instead of feeding the guest, eat the guest or drink the guest. Again, not good hosting. Or else you can be a bad guest as well as a bad host. And the poem is really exploring both of those things.
And
Of
the suitors with Penelope, they're the bad guests.
They're the
They're
bad guests.
overstaying
They,
their
they,
welcome.
they've got showed up uninvited and they're eating all of the host's food and drinking all of his wine. But one could also say Odysseus and his men inside the cave of Polyphemus, they've also entered uninvited. And so there are ways that
And that's a
Odysseus,
Cyclops,
the
right?
Cyclops, so Odysseus performs these roles as both guest and host.
Can we also say that the Trojan horse sort of violates this as well by, you know, by hiding in the horse and then dragging it into Troy and then coming out and killing
You know, I
everybody?
found that one of the most confusing things about this film, because within the archaic tradition, it's the Trojans who violate Xenia because Paris was a guest at the house of Menelaus. One of the things you're not supposed to do is run off with the host's wife. And that's actually a real big no-no within the norms of archaic Greece. So the Trojan War is typically represented as a war of avenge against an initial, a vengeance against an initial violation of Xenia. This movie seems to suggest there's some connection between
using deception to make war and a violation of Zinnia, which I honestly couldn't wrap my head around. And I've been thinking about it ever since I saw the film. I still can't make any sense of that. They're not guests. They've been besieging the city for 10 years. That's not a guest-host relationship.
One interesting thing with Zinnia is that it's not specifically Greek concept. It's quite a pan-ancient concept, so to speak. Seems to be a constant in the ancient world. So the Sanskrit phrase, for instance, Atiti Devo Bhava, the guest is God, expresses a remarkably similar idea. You know, that a guest may be a god in hiding. That's the idea, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And in the Indian epics, like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, they contain many episodes in which the treatment of guests become a test of virtue, very much as in the Odyssey. So the question becomes, I think, why is Zinnia so universal? Why is it so important? Why do they put such an emphasis on it? And, you know, in a time before inns, police, passports, or reliable states, every traveler was vulnerable. If strangers weren't protected, trade, diplomacy, pilgrimage, learning, or even ordinary travel would be almost impossible. So hospitality wasn't just kindness. It was essential to civilization.
And to survival, right? And to survival.
It's a survival, and civilization. As Emily was saying, it's moving out of the family.
But I wonder, too, you know, in these times that we're living in, where it does feel like everything is, not everything, but so much is in turmoil, people are cut loose, they are migrating, they're trying to get from one country to another. This notion of Zinnia, of hospitality, seems... that there was a message somehow that at least Nolan was sending out about how we're supposed to treat each other.
How we're supposed to treat each other. I mean, I think the original poem, of course, in some ways comes from a time that parallels our own, because the Greek-speaking world was a time of huge expansion of Greek speakers living in all kinds of places beyond the Greek mainland, forming settlements and colonies all over the Mediterranean world. So this question of how do we live with people who are not like us, who are ethnically or culturally different, who have different food ways? Is it possible to form communities that where people aren't all the same? And of course, that's a really pressing question in our times of climate change and migration and all of that. Yes, all these fraught questions about immigration.
Indeed. And Neil, I mean, sharing a meal with somebody, even a friend or a family member, but significantly a stranger, that can be a bonding experience, a form of human connection. So the next time you see them, they're not a stranger because you have shared this thing together.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the highest form of sharing is a meal, especially for me. The wine love, it's so important. And, you know, having wine there is also very important. And I agree with Emily, the food seemed disgusting.
Yeah, it did look disgusting.
Some of it, I think, was supposed to be.
What kind of sorceress can't cook?
I mean, she was great, but it was a memorably horrible sorceress.
That's the first step of sorcery, learning how to cook.
I want to squeeze in one more question, and this has to do with the end of the movie and the book. The end of the movie, they kind of, Odysseus and Penelope sort of ride off into the sunset on their boat. The book's ending is so very different.
Yes, on their Viking boat, which I think I thought was...
On their Viking boat, yes.
Which is fun. I mean, you've got to mix it up a little bit. So Nolan, I mean, maybe there's a... Are we spoiling the film? Is it all right? So as you say, they ride off on the boat. Nolan is drawing very, very heavily from Tennyson's poem Ulysses, where Ulysses in Tennyson's poem... leaves Telemachus in charge of the ruling, and he's bored of just staying at home with what he calls, kind of rudely, an aged wife, and then goes off beyond the sunset to strive to seek to find and not to yield. But Nolan reinvents that as a journey to redemption, to bury and respect those that he's wronged, those who have died on his watch,
That's one of the most powerful Christian themes. Sorry.
Very Christian. Right. It's all about the journey to redemption, the journey towards finding some kind of spiritual absolution. The original poem doesn't end in any of those ways. Instead, we have the encounter between Odysseus and the fathers and families of those he's slaughtered. So in a way, it's in keeping with what I was saying before about how this poem is interested in society and what's the effect on others of what Odysseus has done.
I hate to leave it there, but I thank both of you very much for joining us today on The Connection. Yes, we all got thumbs up here, so thank you very much, especially talking about The Odyssey. And Emily Wilson, thank you for coming in and for writing this book as well.
Thank you very much.
And she's a department chair, professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania, working on another Odyssey book. And Neil Burton, thank you for joining us today as well. He's a psychiatrist and philosopher at the University of Oxford, has written a number of books, including ones about wine and one called The Meaning of Myth. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. Debbie Builder produces the show. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.